Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
The Bhagavad Gita is perhaps the most important scripture of Hinduism, but it's also a hugely influential philosophical and spiritual text which remains widely read today, 2,000 years after it was written. With me to discuss the Bhagavad Gita are Chakravarti Ram Prasad, Professor of Comparative Religion and Philosophy at Lancaster University, Julius Lipner, Professor of Hinduism and the Comparative Study of Religion and Fellow of Clare Hall at the University of Cambridge, and Jessica Frazier, Research Fellow at the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies and Lecturer in Religious Studies at Regent's College, London. Ram Prasad, the Bhagavad Gita is part of a longer work called the Mahabharata. Could you explain what that book is and where that comes from, the Mahabharata first?
The Mahabharata is in many ways a compendium of narratives that were written or composed somewhere between about the 3rd or 4th century BCE and the 3rd or 4th century of the Common Era. The core story concerns a struggle for power between two sets of brothers who are themselves cousins. The ethical complexity of the contest between them comes from the fact that one group of brothers, the Pandavas, who were five, could have inherited the kingdom from their father, but he had to give it up in very particular circumstances. So the kingdom passed to his younger brother, whose sons are the other set of brothers, the 100 Kauravas. And the problem comes from the fact that there are reasons why both of these groups of brothers can claim the throne. On the one hand, there is an ethical concern that the kingdom should pass on to those who are entitled to do so. And on the other hand, you have real political considerations that those who are in power should not have the stability of their rule challenged. So the Mahabharata itself leads up inexorably to a battle between these two sides. The story in it, which has retained the moral and religious connection to Hindus since then, comes through the presence of an enigmatic figure in it called Krishna. Now, Krishna is cousin to both these sets of cousins. And in himself, he is the ruler of a minor principality, although known as a great warrior. But the real story for most Hindus is, across the length of the Mahabharata, especially in its later parts, he is gradually revealed as God. Now, he plays a crucial role in this. On the one hand, his armies fight for the Kauravas. And on the other hand, in order to be neutral to the two sides, he offers himself in a non-combatant role, and the Pandavas accept him as such. So the Bhagavad Gita happens just on the eve of this battle between the two sides, in which all the kingdom and all the rulers of ancient India are ranged on either side. On the battlefield, the most important of the warriors on the side of the Pandavas, Arjuna, looks to the other side, and there he sees his teachers, his elders, his great uncle, people who he respects greatly, arranged against him. Now, they have chosen to do this because they think that they have to serve the ruler who is on the throne at that time. So although they really support the Pandavas, they feel that they have to fight for the Kauravas.
Can I just go for one moment to Julius Lipner, just to take a little more about the Bhagavad Gita itself. Where and when was it written, in what language? It's been well described by Ramasa where it is in the Mahabharata and what the Mahabharata is, so we have the context, we have the holding operation. What about the Gita itself, which seems that it has been something that can be plucked out of this enormous epic?
Well, yes, that's how it's been treated by Hindu tradition and by scholars outside Hindu tradition, as if it were a self-contained text. There's scholarly dispute as to whether the Gita is an integral part of the text or not. It is written in Sanskrit, and Sanskrit is an anglicized form of Samskrita, and Samskrita means polished, refined. So nobody believes that on the battlefield, except perhaps very few fundamentalists, nobody believes that Krishna and Arjuna spoke to each other in polished Sanskrit verse, and it's also written in verse. It's got a wonderful cadence to it. The date of the Gita is, again, a subject of dispute, and scholars have placed it anywhere from the 4th or 5th century BC to the 3rd or 4th century CE. I think it's written really, or it was composed round about the beginning of the Common Era. And it occurs, it's been handed down, it's the received version, is 700 verses in 18 chapters. But it's in a beautiful language, and this language, Sanskrit, has its own gravitas, its own majesty, its own cadence. So this has resonated down the ages and has gripped the minds, the psyches of Hindus of all persuasions down the ages.
Is it possible to say how the Gita fits in to the religious complexities of India at that time? Jessica, can you take that on, this mix, which, from what I've read, it was an extraordinary seething mass. But did the Gita self-consciously try to be something that synthesized? Did it set out to, is there any sense that it set out to do that, or what?
That's one of the biggest questions that academics would like to be able to answer. It's one of the great mysteries, in a way. It's a hugely pluralistic culture. We think of ourselves in the modern world now as global, pluralistic, lots of cultures. But actually, that's what's happening at that time in India. You've got lots of different tribes, and they all have their own gods. You've got lots of different kingdoms. It's a bit like ancient Greece in their own power struggles. You've got Brahmins trying to maintain their power, kings claiming their own power. And you've got lots of different philosophical systems vying with each other, the Vedic ritualists, the Vedanta philosophy, Samkhya, which is a sort of an ancient Gnostic philosophy that divides spirit and matter. You've got yoga, you've got these new people around, the Buddhists and the Jains. So there's a huge sense of competition between different groups. And I think more than anything, the Gita is facing a very major tension in the culture between this new ascetic mode of religion. People, you know, young people are leaving their homes, leaving their professions, leaving their villages, literally going out into the forest to focus on a very otherworldly goal of moksha, of trying to achieve liberation. This is exciting, it's compelling, it's powerful. But on the other hand, you've got people saying, what about the world? What about society? What about dharma? Are you really going to give
dharma
up?
Dharma being something approximately linked to duty.
Exactly. What about your social duty, righteousness, your concern for social justice and the people around you? How are we going to reconcile these two major religious concerns? Very universal question in many ways. And I think the Gita, my own feeling is that the Gita is a very intelligent text. Whoever it was composed by in its detail, it does an excellent job of coming up with very coherent concepts that manage to bring all of these ideas, these many gods, these many religious styles and philosophies, together in one single coherent text.
We don't have any idea who wrote it.
Oh, golly.
That's another one, is it? Shall we pass on that and do another program actually wrote it?
Yeah, exactly. There are debates. Some people will say it was the Brahmins who are bringing sort of classic Vedantic philosophy forward into this new kingly ethos of the urban culture that's developed at that time. Other people will say it's the Kshatriyas, the kings, who are developing their own philosophy that's coherent with their active worldly way of life. We don't really know.
What's fascinating about that, and we must resist it, or I must resist it, is that everything you said and what's been said before touches on, you mentioned the Greeks and the references spring up in one's mind to the Greek gods and Zeus being like Krishna and the teachings in the New Testament. So it's all swirling around these religions, which is extraordinarily exciting. But let's stick to this. The Gita, the action of the book is actually a discussion, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it's had all this power, but we're talking about it. A man is overlooking the enemy. He's gone into a hill, and his charioteer, who is also the god Krishna, who has said to them, one of you can have my army, the other you're going to have me, and he's taken him. Krishna is in discussion with this young man as to whether or not he should lead the army against what he sees across the hill as his cousins, old friends, teachers, and so on. Why should he waste everybody's life is a very sensible question he asks, and the charioteer Krishna responds to him. So we're talking about action, as it were, delayed, through by this huge discussion between them? Well, let's get to that, Ram. Krishna uses three main arguments to try to persuade Arjuna, if we could go through them quite briskly, but he won't give in until the final clincher of the final argument, will he? So can we just have the first one? There's a metaphysical argument, a correct action argument, and a devotion to God argument.
That's right. Yes. So the first argument is an argument about philosophical insight. And essentially it says what you take to be this world of individual human beings embedded in social relationships is not all there is. Underneath what you take to be this solid, substantial individual called Arjuna is a core self, a metaphysical self called the Atman. That is eternal. It is the same for and in all. And it is directly under my supervision. So when you act, who you take to be acting, this person with this particular history of being a brother, a husband, a leader, is only on the surface. The people you kill, even if you take them to be on the surface level, your teachers and your cousins, are not. In the end, there is this utter metaphysical principle called the Atman. Once you have that insight, you are equanimous about the ups and downs of life, the joy of victory, the horrors of war, because underneath it all is this unchanging reality.
Arjuna replies to that, "That might be, but I'm concerned about the present and the immediate action, but I do not want to kill these people." So they move to the second argument.
Exactly. Yes. So the second argument is the argument for carrying out your duty. And it says, well, in this world, you are this warrior. You have a responsibility to your elder brother who's the claimant to the throne. You have a responsibility to protect the honor of your wife who was dishonored by your cousins. You've got all these people who are fighting for you and who look up to you as this general and this great prince.
And being born into the warrior caste, your duty is to continue to be a warrior.
That is right. So you cannot. So it's an argument against outer renunciation. But as Jessica was saying, the Gita has to engage with the fact that renunciation had become a very gripping alternative in that world.
To leave the world. Especially for princes, it seems.
Especially for princes, going back to the Buddha. Yeah. So Krishna says, what you need is a renunciation which is inner. You give up your desire for the fruit of your action. You act because you have to act. And the psychological view you bring to bear on that is that action is done for the sake of preserving order, not for what one might benefit from it.
But Arjuna turns that down as well. So Krishna then turns to reveals that he is, apart being a friend and a charity, he is God.
That's the clinching argument.
He is the
argument.
One God.
That's the clinching argument.
And if Arjuna goes along with him, his sins will be absolved and he'll live without shame and sin. And that is the clincher.
That's the clincher.
So, Julius, is it true that one could say that is the central concern of the book? Something that could be summed up in the word dharma?
Yes, I think dharma is the central concern of the Mahabharata, and it's the central concern of the Gita.
Could you just tell listeners precisely what you... Because it's very difficult to translate these words. They're a very complex translation. Yes. Can you just tell us what you think dharma really means?
Dharma means, well, as my colleagues have indicated, it is almost impossible to translate it by one word. But it comes from the Sanskrit word meaning to support, to bear up. Mm-hmm. And therefore, dharma has, and certainly the time of the Gita had, a descriptive content and a prescriptive content. In other words, dharma told you what you were, what things are like, what they should be like. And so the dharma of fire is to burn. The dharma of water is to make things wet and to be mobile and fluid. The dharma of a kshatriya is to fight. And then there is also a prescriptive content, means what you should be doing. And you have this, on the one hand, tension between the descriptive and the prescriptive in the Gita, and on the other hand, a kind of resolution of this tension.
Is this one of the reasons why it carried so strongly and carried through the centuries, had so many commentaries written about it? Is it because of the tensions that you've just described?
Yeah, I think this is the central tension of the Gita. How can one act? How can one do what is righteous, dharma, what you should be doing, in terms of who you are, what your nature is? And it's the tension between these two that you have to resolve in your own life. So there's no simple answer for everybody. You can't take it off the shelf and say, this is the dharma for, well, three of us, because it's a situational term. This is my dharma here and now in terms of what I should do and in terms of what I am. How do I resolve these things?
It's amazing resonances, aren't there, all over the place. Jessica, another idea is important, which a word which people listening will know very well, yoga, which comes there. But what does that precisely mean here in this context, and how does it relate to karma? I'm pronouncing the R as told by you, because it's not karma as in the Karma Sutra, it's karma something else, and bhakti and so on.
Mm-hmm. In a way, as Ram and Julius have both said, this is a text that's helping people to live in the world while, in a sense, becoming yogis, becoming the great yoga practitioners at the same time.
But what would a great yoga practitioner mean then, and why was it so compelling?
Well, originally, this is what's interesting, is that to achieve this, the Gita's having to completely change the meaning of what yoga was before. If you go back to the Vedic roots of the word yuj, it comes from, which is linked to the English yoke, to harness something, to link something. It was used to link the human world to the divine world through rituals, the yajna. If you move on about 500 years, it's turned into yoga, an internal ritual, a discipline that you do with your mind and your body, where you can, in a sense, link mind and body to a higher purpose, a higher reality. That's what the Buddhists, the Jains, and the Hindus are all using it for. But it's a tough practice. Everyday people can't ditch their kids, their jobs, their society and go out to do this kind of yoga, which was really an ascetic practice. So the Gita's going to use this idea to create a religious form that everyone can be part of. And what it does is it says yoga is now no longer something you do with your body. It's now no longer merely a disciplined ascetic meditative practice. It's something that happens on the inside. It's a new internal attitude of detachment from the world. And it's what your attitude is that really matters. It's your intention, not your action. And maybe the last transformation that the Gita affects that makes this viable for everyone is that it's no longer about desperately struggling to focus through meditative practice. Very hard to achieve complete focus in life. But the Gita says, you know what will help you focus better than anything? Love. Complete commitment, complete and overwhelming love for God is the thing that will help you achieve a complete yogic state.
Is this new then? Is this formulation in the Gita one of the things that's original about it? As we're talking, there seems to be more and more things. It's such a very compact and rich work. But is this one of the things that's new in it?
It is. It is one of the...
Yes.
It is. In fact, it's so important. It's the lens through which the subsequent tradition seeks to resolve, in a manner comparable to medieval Christianity, the tension between this personal God, this subject who is available, who's at one and the same time the ground of all being.
So
who
someone
is beyond that?
Someone he can talk to, Arjuna actually addresses him as a friend. You're talking to me, I'm your friend in the same chariot. And then he reveals himself, which is the convincing argument, like Zeus did, reveals himself as the God. Julius, what is this telling people who are reading it or are listening to it? I presume it was read aloud. What is it telling them about how to lead their lives then in that society?
Well, what it's doing is saying there is a supreme being, there is a God, this is a personal God, a provident God, a God who shows preemptive love, because as Jessica was saying, Krishna creates the situation in terms of which you can respond to him. So Krishna takes the initiative. And it says in chapter 4, for the first time significantly in Hindu tradition, that this God has actually descended in human form, the avatara, the concept of descent. It's not strictly an incarnation, but it's a descent in embodied form to show this love in practical and concrete ways. And he says very specifically, this is to uphold dharma, this is to protect the good, and this is to discountenance the evildoers. So there is a purpose in God's coming down, which is both personal and universal.
so many people might say that Arjuna's being convinced to go to war is not a good result for God.
Well, you see, Arjuna being convinced to go to war is an expression of his duty as a Kshatriya, because he has to fight in accordance with who he is and what he should do. But God is the... I think this is not a sugar daddy view of God. I mean, here is God who is the creator, the maintainer, but also the destroyer of everything. And you get in chapter 11, I think it's 11 verse 32, where Krishna says, I am time, matured time, destroying these worlds. So the whole substance of creation, the beginning, the maintenance, and the destruction, all this comes from God. All this is part of God's dispensation, and we play a part in that role.
Can we turn to the influence of the Gita, please? Jessica Fraser, how is the Gita placed inside the confluence of religions which are passing through India and which India is helping to distribute to other parts of the world and so on? Is there any way that that question gets the answer it doesn't really deserve?
I think we talked about the idea that it's uniting lots of different strands, and there's a reason that it becomes such an important text. It's very coherent. It's very accessible. It's interesting that for philosophers, the philosophers that Ram was talking about, there were three key sources that you had to engage with: the Upanishads, the Brahma Sutra, which are both very philosophical texts, and the Gita, which is part of a popular poem. It's perhaps the only one that everyday people would have known and been familiar with. So it's kind of incorporating, it's almost the victory of the popular. It's allowing something that people understand, appreciate, engage with in their own lives to become part of the great high canon of Sanskrit literature. And as such, it's going to set the foundation for future theological developments. I think one of the things it does more than anything is bring in bhakti, which means personal devotion to a personal God. It's very much more emotional, much more engaged, much more, in some ways, more compelling at a popular level, sense that people's love for God is what's going to lead them toward liberation. That's championed in the Gita, and it's laying the foundation for the kind of popular devotional Hinduism that we see still in India today. Without the Gita, perhaps that wouldn't have become quite such a pervasive foundation of Indian religion.
Is reincarnation part of this, Julius Nutner?
Yes, and Krishna says several times to Arjuna, I will rescue you from rebirth, from the ocean of rebirth. So this apparent cycle of being where you keep on going, because reincarnation for Hindus is not a desirable thing. It's a miserable thing. This world is called...
Is it evidence of failure?
It's evidence of failure in one respect, that you haven't actually achieved the final goal. But this world is called Dukhalayam, an abode of sorrow. And so Krishna offers to rescue the devotee of his.
It was very much taken up by the English, the British over there, the Oriental Society, and British scholars who became fascinated by and did quite a lot of work on aspects of Indian thought and Indian religion and philosophy. Can you tell us what they made of the Gita and why they went for it? Why they almost adopted it so enthusiastically?
I think it's interesting to see the rest of the world, especially the world of Christian, Jewish, Muslim religion, where they have clear founders of the religion, where you have clear texts that are canonical. They get to India and...
You have
the book, you have the doctrine, you have creed, you have a founder. You get to India and you don't have any of these things in any clear way. It's one of the world's most pluralistic and diverse cultures. So the British and other Europeans are trying to figure out what is the core they can latch on to that will make sense of things. Many Hindu texts are vast. The Vedas are vast. The Puranas are huge texts. There are many huge texts. But the Gita is a small, clear text that brings together most of the key threads of Indian philosophy. So it's really important, I think, in that way, to give people a handle by which to start to have access to the richness of Indian culture.
In the way they did it, Ram, did they skew it to a parallel to the New Testament too much for the good of scholarship, or did they turn it, did they westernize it, did they miss a lot?
Well, the first translation, which was, I think, about 1785, was actually fairly accurate, because the original encounter, Wilkes, the The original Western scholars of the Gita were actually people who learnt the languages. They were deeply engaged in a retrieval of an oral culture. I think the reinterpretations of the Gita, we wouldn't really call them skewed because they are themselves interesting insights into why and how people read these materials. And some of these creative interpretations are as much by Hindus themselves in the 19th century seeking to repossess this text as by Westerners, especially at the sort of the height of the Enlightenment, wanting to see in it parallels to the West, but also equally trying to find what was original about India, what was so other about India.
Mm. Jessica?
Just absolutely affirming that. And yet it's also interesting to see that sometimes they missed what was so different and distinctively Hindu about the Gita. It's is not to be forgotten. This isn't just one God. Krishna sounded like Christ. It's many gods. In many ways, Krishna affirms all the other gods that are available in India. So it's a much more tolerant text than people realized. And he doesn't tell you what to do. At the end of this great speech, he says to Arjuna, "That's my view. You now have to decide." So it's not a text that wants to instruct you what you have to do. It's a text that wants to advise you and yet leave open a certain openness for the individual to make their spiritual choices. And that made it popular on a very wide scale in the West as well.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.